Espírito Médio Óbvio. And McDonald's, and it's an article about the decline in our society, and it's not actually an article about the negatives that migrants bring to our society, but more of a commentary on the way that migration, and specifically overpopulation, affects the mental well-being of a host population and causes that host population to behave differently, not only towards the groups coming in, but also towards members of their own group. And it's about a 4,500 word article. There's some good stuff in there. And I talk about sort of the general changes we've seen in our society. And this all sort of struck me when I was away with the family, and we went to a McDonald's restaurant. We stopped in there on our travels, just, you know, quick, easy food, kids in the car, everyone's hungry. You're on the way to holiday, and you stop off, you grab something to eat, and something struck me about the changes we've seen in McDonald's over the last 40 years. And that might sound really odd, and it might sound really sort of random to be talking about something like that. But I think if you read the article, you'll see that there's a much deeper meaning there. And I certainly think it's a worthwhile read. And I go into an experiment that took place called, well, it's either called Mouse Utopia or Universe 25, where a scientist put mice into an enclosure and gave them sort of perfect breeding conditions until they became so overpopulated that there was catastrophic changes in what was known as a behavioral sink. And my article sort of compares what's happening in Western nations like Britain, specifically Britain, but also obviously America, France, Germany, with what happened in that experiment and the effect that overpopulation and overcrowding has on humans and the way it changes our behavior. So definitely something I think is a worthwhile read. I wouldn't have written it in the first place, and I hope you enjoy it. Remember, everything that goes up on my Substack goes up free of charge, so you can read that. You don't have to pay, but if you do want to become a paid subscriber and support me, that would be very, very much appreciated. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, we're finally getting round to reviewing Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. We're going to be doing that on Sunday night at 8 p.m., and that will be myself and the usual film club guys. I've watched most of the film, and I'll have a few interesting takes on that. I'm probably will be saying things that you won't quite expect, so do check that out. Now, if you like these streams, and this is going to be a more in-depth stream tonight, please consider making a donation. You can donate live through Rumble at any time, and I appreciate any financial support greatly. Now, I was coming up to this weekend, and I like to do a stream on Friday nights. I used to do the videos, but I tend to do the essays, and I do two essays a week rather than one video, and then I do a stream on Friday night. And I always like to talk about something different. And it was coming up to this Friday, and I didn't really know what I was going to talk about. I was in a bit of a quandary. I thought to myself, should I talk about what's gone on in the news cycle? And there have been a few things in the news cycle, but these things have mainly been related to sort of migrant crime. And I thought to myself, you know what? Doing an hour-long stream on migrant crime probably isn't going to cut it. Now, I'm not saying these things aren't important, but I talk about these things a lot. I have a lot of guests on who want to talk about these things, and I chronicle them extensively. And I think there's only so much you can say about migrant crime. Now, there are obviously big cases like the Henry Novak killing, something like the Manchester Arena bombing, the Southport stabbings, and those things require extensive deep dives. But when it's just another migrant, you know, I don't know, doing something horrific, you can't really spin that into a show. Well, you can, but it does get a bit repetitive. So I like to use these shows to do something more of a deep dive. And one thing that struck me, because yesterday there was a number of by-elections, and some of these by-elections were caused because reform councillors have quit or stood down and by-elections have been called. And the media's made an awful lot of noise about this. So the BBC always covers these resignations as national news. Now, this tells you what an absolutely awful organisation the BBC is. You should never, ever pay your licence fee. The BBC are scum, and everyone there deserves to be made unemployed. Absolute human filth. Now, Labour councillors, Tory councillors, mainstream councillors, they resign all the time. By-elections are called all the time. And the BBC always relegates that news to the relevant local section. So BBC Hertfordshire, BBC Wiltshire, BBC, Look North. And it's like, a Lib Dem councillor in Halifax resigned because his wife's in ill health. There'll be a by-election, blah, blah, blah. And it's local news because it is a local issue. And it's not really worthy of national news. But I've noticed that every time a reform councillor resigns, in some sleepy backwater, it's national news. The BBC will pump that out to as many people as possible to make it look like reform's in disarray, to make it look like the party is failing, and to make it look like they don't know what they're doing. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this because reform are in an interesting position. They have won the last two rounds of English council elections. Now, not one with a majority, but being the party who has won the most seats. Now, that's a massive thing for an outsider party to win the most seats at a council election is huge. But to do it twice in a row is just unprecedented. And Reform have managed that twice in a row. They managed it this year, 2026, and they managed it the year before, 2025. They've really moved up a gear post the last general election, and especially under Starmer. Starmer was really, really turning people off. Obviously, I'm not sure how many white working class people want to vote for a Nigerian woman. I don't think Kemi Badenoch's winning them over. So Reform were really going up a gear and winning a lot of seats. And this was obviously worrying the establishment. The BBC then decides to say how badly it's going because a handful of them have resigned. And I wanted to talk about this because when a new party, or a relatively new party, wins a large number of council seats, it does make a big difference in people's mind. People are like, wow, that's huge. But then people want to see results. People are going to then start asking, what's actually happening? Have these people actually made our lives any better? Is it making a difference? We're voting for this new party. They're winning these elections. They're taking control of councils. I live in Wakefield. They took control of Wakefield Council. I think Wakefield Council's got something like 53 councillors. Reform ended up getting 51 of those councillors or something like that. It was an overwhelming number. And this led to a complete changing of the guard. Labour had won control of Wakefield shortly after the Second World War and had never relinquished it. But now we've got a reform council. But what is actually changing? And is anything changing for the better? Because there's no point going to the ballot box and voting for people if there's not actually going to be a change. So I wanted to examine this. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why when outsider councillors get elected, you don't always get the result that you'd hope for. You don't always get the big changes that you'd hoped for. And a lot of people are going to say, look, Mark, that's because it's reform. Reform are a busted flush. Reform are part of the establishment, yada, yada, yada. But I'm going to break this to you. Exactly the same happened when the BNP got councillors elected. And that might shock you because the BNP obviously was a radical racial nationalist party. But unfortunately, when the BNP got council elected, they sort of experienced exactly the same problems that reform are experiencing now And that might seem strange, but we're going to draw some parallels. But as I was preparing this stream, the news came in that was a by-election yesterday in Dover, of all places. And I've been predicting for a long time that eventually Restore would stand against Reform. They would split the vote. That happened. And that's obviously big news today as well. And I'm going to talk about that. We're going to have a talk about that at the end. If I'd have waited till this morning to queue up the stream, that's what it would all be about. It would all be about the Reform Restore vote split. I've spoken about it before. It's actually happened. We've got facts and figures now. I am going to talk about that at the end. And I'll also take questions and answers from you guys. Now, I'm not expecting this to be a wild stream with thousands of people watching. It's a bit of a niche topic, but it's a topic I wanted to talk about. And sometimes, as I said, I don't talk about the most salacious thing in the news. I'm not just going to queue up a stream because an asylum seeker has done something terrible again. I like to discuss things in a more in-depth way. So if you're in for that kind of thing, buckle up and enjoy this stream, because I've got a lot of perspective on this, and I'm probably one of the few people in Britain who can talk about something like this, because I've been there and I've been on the inside of a party that won seats and then wasn't really able to deliver on the promises that were made. So here goes. Now, the first thing I want to say is Reform's councillors underperforming, if you can call it that, isn't actually anything to do with Reform being a bad party or the councillors being bad people or them being underqualified or inept. There's a series of issues here, and some of those issues are based around the councillors themselves. Some of them are based around the way councils are run. Some of them are based around changes in local governance that have been made recently. And some of them are about a wider set of nationalist beliefs or our mindset, and why I don't actually think that nationalists always make the best local councillors. And that might be an incendiary thing to say, because I've known plenty of nationalist councillors. I'm not really sure that nationalist councillors have always delivered what they hope to deliver or what voters have hoped they would deliver. Now, why does this happen? Well, firstly, what prompted me to write this was, I didn't really write it, I sort of script out some bullet points, but to produce this stream was the following story. So we're going to start with a little bit of a story. And it's about this lady. Now, you know, here she is. Her name's Helen Butler. I think she's a very attractive looking woman. She's very well presented. All the pictures of I've seen of her, she looks very attractive. She's pretty. She's well presented. She always looks very well dressed. She's the kind of woman that you would want representing your political party. But she's resigned from the county council. Now, you might say she's let down the voters. So let's have a read of this. A Reform UK councillor has announced she has quit her seat on Leicestershire County Council. Helen Butler, who was division councillor for Shepshed, said it had been an incredible honour to represent the town, but wanted to spend more time with her family. Butler was elected in May 2025 when Reform took control of the county council as a minority administration. She was appointed as cabinet member for finances and resources, but stepped down from that post in October, citing family commitments. Now, as I said, on the surface, she is the perfect candidate. She's the kind of person you would want standing for your party. Back in the day when I was in the BNP, if we had a woman like Helen come forward, attractive, well-dressed, well-spoken, well-presented, a mother, that's the kind of person you'd want representing you. The perfect candidate. But she didn't last very long. She was elected, when did it say again? Just to check, she was elected in 2005, and a little over a year later, she's gone. She couldn't hack it. Now, couldn't hack it, though, is an interesting sort of thing to say, because it's not really that she couldn't hack it. And the BBC left out some crucial information, as you'd expect they would, because they're a scummy organisation. Basically, she was spending so much time on this job, and it took up so much of her evenings in meetings, specifically council meetings, that she wasn't at home to put the kids to bed. She wasn't reading her kids' bedtime stories anymore. She didn't have time, just plait her daughter's hair before she went to bed and do the bath and bed and the shower and all of the things that mums do. So Helen said, look, I can't do this. I've got to put my family first. And you know what? I completely agree with that. I think that's a good reason for standing down. But you see, this is part of the problem with smaller parties. They do attract some bad people and some unsuitable people. And all parties do that. But they also attract a lot of good-hearted, decent people who don't really know what they're getting into. Now, Helen is absolutely not a bad person. I think, I think she looks lovely. I've praised her heavily. And this stream isn't about dragging her or saying anything bad about her or her family. I've got nothing bad to say about her. I don't think she's a bad person at all. But she was pulled into something because she wanted to do something good, but she didn't really know what she was getting into. And that's not really her fault. And it's also not really Reform's fault. And this happened in the BNP. It happened with numerous councillors. When you're a small party or part of a small party and it's coming up to an election, you want to stand as many people as possible. And I remember this when I was in the BNP. I was in Leeds BNP. And there was always a pressure every year for branch organisers to stand what was called a full slate. So in Leeds, I believe it was, I'm just going to check this actually. Let me Google it. How many council? I think it's 33. How many council wards are there in Leeds? I think it's 33. I might be wrong. Yes, I'm right. I'm right. 33 council wards, 3 councillors per seat, 99 councillors. I was correct. I did remember that, although I haven't done any work in Leeds for a long time in terms of council elections or anything like that. But there's 33 wards. So every year there was huge pressure heaped upon the Leeds branch organiser, who at the time was a guy named Martin Reynolds, who went on to be Nick Griffin's personal security. People have seen him. He was a huge guy, probably assisted by some form of contraband substance. If you saw the size of him, he obviously was. That was a pretty open secret. Big guy, but he worked very hard for the party. And he used to get 33 council candidates. But to get 33 council candidates, you would write to everybody on your mailing list and say, do you want to be a councillor? Will you help us? And if anyone showed the slightest bit of interest, you would do everything you could to badger them into standing. Now, you didn't know if they were going to win. You thought it was probably unlikely they were going to win, but there was always a chance. And you would do everything you can to get them on the ballot, because it would help your party, help the BNP. It made the BNP look credible. And Reform will do that. Restore will eventually do that before anyone goes, Reform on, vetting them properly. You don't. I was there. You want as many people on the ballot as possible. And sometimes people get elected who aren't sure what they're getting themselves into. Not bad people. They're just out of their depth. And I think that what happened with Helen. Now, we had a case like that in Keighley, in Bradford. There was this lady, name was Angela Clark. She got elected in Keighley. She was elected to Bradford Council, but Keighley falls under Bradford, and it was one of the Keighley seats. She was elected, and she quit partway through her term because she couldn't cope with it. She had 2 children. She was a single mum. She was a good-hearted person. I spent an awful lot of my time with her and her children. I knew them very well. I regularly went over there to make sure they were okay. They were living in an area which at the time was the epicenter of the grooming issue. That's why she got elected. She needed a lot of support. And the party at that time prioritised putting paid members of staff in areas where they could help. And I used to go over there regularly and spend time with her and her family and help her with the work as much as I could. I couldn't keep that up forever. And eventually she couldn't cope with it and she left. It was embarrassing for the party. A by-election was called. But I'll tell you this now. She was a good person. I think Helen Butler, good person. But these people were out of their depth. And this happens. So the first reason why smaller parties don't make the impact with their councillors is often the candidates they put forward aren't exactly suitable. And it's not because they're bad people. They're just out of their depth. Now, that's the first reason. The second reason, and this is a big issue. When people are elected to a council and they're elected as a Conservative or they're elected as a member of the Labour Party, they're treated in a different way as to when they're a member of the BNP or a member of Reform. Now, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have existed for Labour Party for over 100 years, the Conservative Party for around 200 years, and they have shaped councils all over the country. And this has created a situation where they have staffed these councils with people who are loyal to them. People within the council hierarchy are friends, sort of maybe even family members of councillors. The councillors have shaped the way the council runs, and the councils are staffed with people who are supportive of the parties that wield power. So a Labour council will staff the council with Labour people. A Tory council will staff the council with Tory people. And that creates a real problem for new councillors, because when you come in there and you're a BNP councillor, or in this case, a Reform councillor, you walk in the door and the staff don't want to help you. The staff are there because they're beneficiaries of the outgoing establishment. And because of that, they're a little bit bitter that you're replacing their friends. You're replacing the people that appointed them. And this creates sort of a conflict of interest where they're often unwilling to help. Now, I'll give an example of this. I remember back in the day, back in the good old days, the BNP, we won 3 seats in Burnley. And shortly afterwards, we went on to win a 4th seat. This time it was in Blackburn. But the next year, the beginning of 2003, there was a by-election in Halifax in the Mixenden ward. And a guy called Adrian Marsden, who was a nationalist stalwart, he stood. And we won that seat narrowly. We narrowly won that seat. And Adrian Marsden became the councillor for that ward. Now, I don't know how big Halifax Council is or was at the time, but he was the lone BNP councillor on that council for a while. In the end, there was 3 councillors in total who were BNP councillors, which allowed them to form a small group. But for a while, he was the lone councillor. And this was something that placed him in an awkward position. And I remember him saying to me, look how much paperwork I have to read. Look what I have to go through before a council meeting. And back then, they used to print everything that you needed. And he showed me a block of paper about that thick. It looked, you know, like a original draft of one of the Lord of the Rings books. It was absolutely massive. And he was like, I've got to read this before every council meeting. I said, how do you do it? He said, I can't. I flick through it. I tried to find the right parts. Now, what they were doing to Adrian was saying, look, here's your reading material. Off you go, mate. And that was it. He was sort of trapped out in the cold. He didn't know what he was doing. He couldn't get any help from the other councillors because they were hostile to him. He couldn't get any help from people within the council who were staffing the council because they were hostile to him, because they'd all been appointed by the local Labour Party and they were friends with the local Labour councillors. So they didn't like him. And it left him absolutely frozen out. So for several months, he didn't really know what he was doing. He didn't know procedure. He didn't know how to raise a point in a council meeting. He didn't know what bits he could speak on. And he simply did not have time, because he had a full-time job, family, etc. He didn't have time to read through, you know, 500-600 sides of A4 to pick out all the detail that he'd need to speak on. So he used to have to play it by ear. Now, it was different for Labour, because the people in the council were working with them. They were friends with them. They would help them. When a new councillor came on board for the Labour Party, not only did they have the support of other Labour councillors, but they also had support of people working within the council itself. And that really gave new Labour councillors this massive, massive head start. But it also acted to lock out councillors like Adrian Marsden. Now, eventually, one of the Conservative councillors in Halifax defected. Another nationalist stalwart, a guy called Richard Mulhall, was elected to Halifax Council. The three of them formed a group. The ex-Tory knew what he was doing because he'd been on the council for some time. And it kind of, you know, solidified as a little group. They pulled themselves together and they muddled their way through. But it was very hard initially. And in a lot of these councils where reform have swept through and pushed out the Labour councillors, they're really struggling to work with people who were deeply embedded in sort of a left-wing, progressive Labour establishment. And I know this, and I'll explain why. I'll explain why in a few moments. Now, the next issue, and this is something where I'll give a sort of a deeper explanation, is not only are these new councillors who've been elected for reform being blocked from within, they're being blocked from above. Now, what I mean by this is national government, despite talking about devolution and handing more powers away to devolved parliaments and regions, it's not really working like that. Councils now have fewer powers than they used to. And most or a lot of the power is held by national government. Now, on a Saturday, I usually do something in the morning with the children. And one of the things I usually do is take them to the local library. We go to the library and there's usually some kind of event there. There's usually some kind of arts and crafts thing, which my daughter really likes. And I'll sit there with my son and I'll read him books. And occasionally he likes to get stuck in with the arts and crafts too, which is usually a disaster because he's 17 months old. And a 17 month old trying to glue things together is not as fun as it may sound. But one week we went down to the library and there were three people sat in a row at the back of the library. And there was a queue of people there to see them. I thought to myself, I think I recognise these three people. And they were the local reform councillors. Now, I said reform had an almost clean sweep in the Wakefield area. So these three reform councillors were in the library doing a meet and greet. Now, the first thing I've got to say is I've never seen, in all my time of living here, I've never ever seen any of the Labour councillors ever do a meet and greet. The only time I've ever seen the local Labour councillors is when there was a ribbon cutting or a press opportunity, a sort of a local school or a local council building where they could turn up, get a snap and be in the local paper. They never came to the library. They never met with normal people. They were useless. But reform, to their credit, have started doing what's called a surgery. And these were things that councillors used to do regularly every month in the library. So if you're a normal person, you can go down to the library, queue up, speak to your three councillors. And I think that's admirable. And that's a major improvement from the old Labour establishment. So I was quite happy to see them there. Now, I didn't really have anything I needed to raise with them. But I did want to speak to them and I wanted to sort of just go and sound them out on a few things because why not? And I did. Now, I listened to what a lot of other people were raising with them. And most people who had queued up to speak to them were raising the issue of planning applications and how they didn't want more houses building in the area. And I could hear the responses and I walked up to them and said, look, have you finished? And they were like, yeah, there's no one else. Are you here to see? I said, well, I'll just have a little chat with you. You know, I'm here with my kids. You've seen me, but like, have a little chat with you. started having a chat with him. I said, I noticed everyone's talking about the planning thing. You know, me and the wife, we were talking about the planning problems in the area, the fact they want new houses on every bit of sort of arable land that they can chew up to build houses on. And we're a bit concerned about sort of overcrowding, the amount of traffic, and the fact that the area has gone from being quite sparsely populated when we moved here to feeling a little bit overcrowded. And they were like, yeah, everyone's got this problem. I said, well, is this something you can deal with? And they were like, can we be completely honest with you? And I, yeah, you know, I voted for you. So yeah, you know, tell me how it is. And they said, look, we want to help you. And we want to help everyone who's come in here, but we don't have the power. And they admitted, they said, the first problems we've had is it's been difficult transitioning into a Labour stronghold and working with the people who are staffing the council. And they also said, we're having major problems with the issues people are raising because we don't have the power to veto them, especially when it comes to planning. The government, central government, Westminster, have placed quotas on every area for new houses. So every area has to take a certain number of new houses at a minimum. And unless you're going over that number, you can't really veto planning applications for new homes. And they were being very honest. You know, they were very nice people. You know, they weren't able to deliver on the things that they wanted to deliver on. One of the things they were talking about, one of the things that was making a lot of people angry in the area, was all the new planning. And they couldn't deliver on this. And it's not because they're bad people. It's not because they were out their depth. These people were totally committed. And I said, I'm not blaming people like Helen Butler or Angela Clark. When you've got children and you feel compelled to do something good for your community, which they did, they ended up out of their depth. This happens. But these guys, they weren't out of their depth. They were there to make serious change, and they were finding that their hands were tied. Their hands were partially tied at local level due to resistance from within the old establishment, which they can't just clear out and sack everyone. And their hands were tied from above. And their hands were tied by the national government. So we're getting the new houses, whether we like it or not. It doesn't matter whether we vote Labour, Tory, Reform, and it doesn't matter how hardworking the Reform councillors are. It doesn't matter how many surgeries they hold or how willing they are to represent the people in the area, which they clearly are, and they're clearly good people. But at the same time, they can't do what they promise. They can't deliver. It's because their hands are tied. Now, the final reason why often nationalists don't make good councillors. And this might actually apply to some of the Reform people who have left. It's because we think differently. Now, local councillors have been really reduced to people who can only deal with what are quite petty issues. Now, some of these issues, like planning, if they could deal with it, would be serious. But some of the issues are like, local guy, the latch on his gate's broken, and he wants help. Local person wants you to come out because there's some graffiti outside his house he doesn't like, and he wants it cleaning off. Now, I'm all for going out and helping people who genuinely need it. You know, if there's an old lady and she's living in a house and somebody's dumped a load of rubbish outside a house and she can't get out of her gate, we come together and we help that person because she needs it and she can't do it herself. But equally, as a nationalist, I'm against the nanny state. And most people involved with parties like Reform or the BNP back in the day are against the nanny state. They think people should be standing on their own two feet. And you tend to find that when people get involved in sort of politics like Reform, BNP, Restore, or the National Front in the 70s, they're not getting involved because they want to fix people's garden gates. They're not getting involved because they want to, you know, pressure wash graffiti off somebody's drive. In fact, if you come to me and say, the latch on my garden gate's broken, mate, what are you going to do? I'm going to say, well, I'm going to tell you to go down to B&Q and buy yourself a new latch and fit it, because that's what I'd do. And one of the problems for local councillors who hold our mindset is they're not going into the council chamber and making the big changes. They're not able to always close the asylum seeker accommodation. They're not able to block the planning applications. They're not able to make a difference to the big macro issues that they care about. The only thing they can do is affect tiny piffling micro issues that they don't give a toss about. And that creates a deep feeling of depression amongst people who are elected on a nationalist ticket, but then can't deliver. And I saw this when I was in the BNP. People would get elected, not all BNP councillors. There were some ones who really, really slotted into the role. Some of them, my mum was a councillor. She was a BNP member. She was a parish councillor, not a full councillor. So I don't count her in the total of BNP councillors that we had back in the day. But the BNP, when she was on Rothley Parish Council, she said all she would do was get called out to people's houses to sit and have a cup of tea and talk about some piffling issue rather than the issues that were close to her heart. And she did it. She soldiered on and she did the best job she could. But she found it mind-numbing. And she found the meetings went on forever, talked about every bit of minutia. And although she liked everyone on the council and got on well with them all by the end of it, and, you know, she enjoyed her time there overall, she wasn't able to affect the change that she wished to. And I think that's an issue for many people who join parties like Reform or Restore or the BNP back in the early 2000s. We get involved because we want to change the way the country runs. And when we get into local government as the first step on that ladder, because the ladder strategy really is the most viable path to victory, once we get on that ladder, those bottom rungs don't allow you to make the changes that you got into politics to make. And when you're walking about, you know, being accosted by people who want to know why the 903 to Hemsworth has now been cancelled and been replaced by the 856, which is just a little bit too early for them because they drop the kids off at school and can't make it. These people don't, you know, the average nationalist council doesn't want to deal with a bus timetable, doesn't want to deal with whether the dog poo bins are spaced far apart enough or whether, you know, the anti-graffiti messaging is correctly spaced and the font is the right font. They're not interested in that. They're interested in stopping our replacement. And this creates a sort of conflict of interest where you're in that room to rage against the system, to rage against immigration, to rage against the fact that judges are putting people in jail for speech crimes and letting paedophiles out, to free up space for more thought criminals. These are the things that you're there to rage about. These are the things that made you angry. These are the things that motivated you and got you into politics. But now you're dealing with dog poo bins and bus timetables. And at the end, it just does your head in. And I knew numerous councillors like this who just couldn't cope with this crap. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to make people sound like they were doing a bad job, because they weren't. There were some councillors who'd go to every little council committee meeting, and there were others that were just like, this is pointless. This is a waste of time. You know, we're dotting I's and crossing T's, but getting nothing done. And I understand that. I understand the fact that you don't want to be dealing with minutia. The minutia is something you want to deal with when you've dealt with the big problems. You know, you deal with the big problems, then you deal with the little things. You know, you do the broad brushstrokes, then you fill in the fine detail. But as a counsellor, you're dealing with the finest detail. And a lot of that are things that you don't want to deal with and that actually go against your belief system. You want people to be more upwardly mobile, to deal with little issues themselves, to work things out. You don't want to be nannying, you know, the local do-nothing who needs the latch on his gate fixing. He can do that himself. I remember that when I was standing for council in Leeds, a family asked me out to help them with an issue. And I went there. And I'm not going to go into it because, you know, I wouldn't want them to be identified or laughed at or anything like that. But I remember walking away and thinking, is this the kind of crap that I'm going to be called out for? Is this what I'm really signing up for? Because really, I signed up to stop mass immigration and to stop white genocide and to stop the replacement of my people. But that wasn't happening. Now, I never actually got elected, but I know people who did in places like Leeds, like Chris Beverley. And he was an excellent councillor, but he spent his life as a councillor chasing people and mopping up their messes and listening to their grievances and sat on committees whilst being overwhelmed with paperwork. And I think all of this creates this swirling mass of problems. You know, the councillors who didn't know what they were getting into, the councillors being blocked from within, the councillors being blocked from above, and the endless grind petty grievances from the public, and it wears these councillors down. And I'm sure when people like Helen Butler signed up to be a councillor, she did it with a good heart, just like people like Angela Clark did for the BNP before she resigned, before other BNP councillors resigned. I'm sure they all did it for the right reason. And when you're in the BNP and a councillor resigns, you're very angry with them. You feel really, you know, at the time you're raging. And I remember being like, that absolute POS, why would they resign? We fought for that seat so hard. They're embarrassing the party. This is a disaster. But looking back on it with a clear head and looking back on it now, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing. You look back and you think, well, I understand now. I understand the pressures heaped on them. But because the system is designed in this way, it creates an environment which is naturally hostile to nationalist or patriotic or anti-immigration councillors. And it doesn't allow us to make the changes we desire at local level. And it gives us the only option of making those changes to form a national government. And that's where the rub is. If you don't perform well locally, you don't win nationally. And if you don't win nationally, you don't make the changes. But if you can't perform well locally because you're being hamstrung at every level, how are you ever going to perform well nationally? And it creates this trap, which I'm sure is being created intentionally, that is there to block outsider councillors getting in. And when they do get in, to make sure they're hamstrung and to make sure they're demoralised and pushed out. So in summation, before we get on to the other reform, restore news, I don't think the reform councillors are bad people, and I don't think they're underperforming due to any fault of their own. However, I do think there is going to be disappointment from reform voters in the long run, because the changes those voters were hoping for are not going to come about, even when they've successfully elected reform candidates. And the problem is, that's not the fault of those reform candidates or reform councillors when they're elected. It's the fault of the system, because the system is designed to disenfranchise and force out people who aren't on board with the system's narrative and with the system's core aims. This is an issue. And I thought this was a particularly important issue, and that's why I wanted to talk about it tonight. I thought this was a bit different to what I usually talk about. But I do prefer giving these lectures. And it's not because I'm looking for a massive audience. And I know there's not going to be like 600 people watching. This isn't me debating, you know, some, you know, Christian universalist or for Jews or anything like that. But I do think this information is important to the movement as a whole. And I think it's important to the movement as a whole, because if we ever wish to move forward, and especially if people ever wish to get involved in local politics, they need to know how to avoid these pitfalls. Now, on to the big issue that I would have been talking about tonight, but I'm not talking about, because, as I said, I queued the stream up earlier than I would have done or should have done. But I want to talk a bit about this by-election in Dover. Now, firstly, the by-election in Dover was important because Dover is one of those sort of totemic places. Dover is important. Dover is the site of most of the mass illegal immigration into Britain. The illegal immigration into Britain is centred in Dover. Now, I'm not sure whether it's the majority of illegal immigrants that come into Dover or whether it's the largest minority. It's about 30, 40%. It might be over 50%. Dover to Calais is the shortest channel crossing. It's where all the ferries go from. You know, if you're shipping, you ship from Dover and you head to Calais. And it works because those two ports are the closest points across the English Channel. So close, in fact, that when you're in Dover, you sometimes pick up a French phone signal. And when you're in Calais, on a clear day, you can see Dover from Calais. That's how close it is. So the migrants go to Calais, they get in the boat, it's the easiest way to cross, they wash up in Dover, and Dover has been a hotbed of nationalist marches, protests, and activity over the years. It's been a place which has been central to the argument over immigration. So when you end up fighting an election in Dover, it's probably more important than when you're fighting an election in somewhere maybe like Leeds or, you know, somewhere in Cumbria, because Dover holds this sort of, you know, totemic position. It's central to what we're doing. So you'd expect in Dover an anti-immigration candidate to win, wouldn't you? Well, now I've been warning for a long time that Restore Britain, despite their activists being well-intentioned, despite them seemingly taking a harder line on certain issues, Restore Britain are not going to get a critical mass behind them, and they will split the anti-immigration vote. So the vote that Reform is getting that's allowed them to win two rounds of council elections, Restore will split that, and it will deliver victory back, most likely, to the Labour Party. Or worse, it could hand victory to the Greens or some kind of unholy alliance between the Greens and the Labour Party. And I've been saying this for some time and saying, look, if this issue isn't addressed, what we're going to end up with is council seats where Reform candidates miss out by a few dozen votes because of Restore, and Labour or the Greens get in. And that's exactly what's happened. So let's have a look at these council results, because they are enraging, embarrassing, but highly illustrative of what I've been warning about. So here's the declaration of the result. And you can see here, shall I zoom in a little bit? Can I zoom in? Is there a zoom? Yeah, there's a zoom. There's a zoom. Here we go. So, election of a district councillor for the Guston, Kingsdown and St Margaret's at Cliff Ward on Thursday, 27 August 2026. And this is in Dover, as I said. And here you can see the result. The winner was the Green Party, 767 votes. Reform, 733. So Reform lost by 34 votes. The Conservatives came in second with 450, third with 454, Labour fourth with 389, then Restore Britain with 284, and finally an independent with 35 votes. Now, if you add the Restore and the Reform votes, Reform easily wins, but Reform didn't win because Restore split that vote. But it gets worse, and it gets actually more embarrassing, or just worse altogether, just worse than it was a few seconds ago, if you can believe it. And the reason it gets worse is because Restore I know the people who ran that campaign for Restore. I know that they were bussing people in from all over the country to try and prove a point. And I'm not going to name and shame people. But the fact they almost made that a national mobilization, yet got outpolled by Reform 3-1, split the vote and handed the victory to the Greens, is absolutely shameful. But it vindicates everything that I've said. Absolutely vindicates everything that I've said. And I'll tell you this. It's worse than just Labour winning. The Greens won. The Greens are the most pro-migrant, pro-trans, pro-white replacement party elected to Westminster at the moment. And they've just won a seat in Dover. So Dover, the epicenter of illegal immigration into Britain. And the people of Dover, due to this vote split, have now elected a councillor who wants more illegal immigration, a councillor who wants more migrants coming in, a councillor who wants to be on the beaches welcoming the illegals as they come off with towels and food and hot drinks. What a shameful situation. And it's something I've predicted. I'm going to say this. This is why I'm banned from places like X. Because if I was there with all my supporters, I'd probably have 150,000, 200,000 people following me now. Because I was the biggest British nationalist account on X before I was banned. They took all that away from me. So instead of somebody like me warning about these things and trying to steer the conversation in the right way, the people on X now are like, get down there for Restore, get down there for Restore. All this is going to do, like I predicted, is gift wins to the far left. And if this continues into 2029 in the next general election, Restore Britain will achieve one thing, and that will be a second term for the Labour Party. Burnham will win a second term for the Labour Party, and the next chance to unseat the Labour Party will likely be 2034. Now, we're declining at a rate of about 0.8% a year. White Britons are. Now, when it comes down to it, if we wait another, what is it, 2026 now, so if we wait another 8 years, we're going to have a drop of between 6 and 7% of the share of the population. Now, we're around 70% now. So at the next, not at this general election, but the general election after that, we could be as little as 62 to 63% of the population. And it gets increasingly more difficult to win. The highest ever percentage of the vote any party has ever received post-Second World War is 49.7%. No party has ever achieved a national majority. But let's say a party could get 50%. Well, if we, as white Britons, in 2034... are around 63% of the population. That means if 50% of white Britons voted for an ethno-nationalist party, which would be highly unlikely because it'd be unprecedented, that would only mean 31.5% of the population was voting for that ethno-nationalist party. And the fact of the matter is this. The lowest vote any party has ever received, which allowed them to form a national government in Westminster, was Labour in 2024, and they took 33.7%. So once we dip under about 67% of the overall population, unless we do deals with ethnic minority groups, it would make it almost impossible for us to be able to form a majority in Parliament based on every statistical fact that exists. And there's no point talking crap, is there? There's no point being like, oh, well, what if 70% of the white people voted for us? That's not going to happen. Statistically, that has never happened. Statistically, on a national level, no party ever has received that level of national support. This places us in a really ugly predicament where it could well be that the next general election is the last time that white British people have the numerical power to win the election without the help of ethnic minority votes. That's where we are. We're at a historic tipping point. But instead of us uniting in some way, we've got the biggest vote split the right has ever seen in this country. And that vote split is going to hand this last crucial general election to Labour. And I'm the one who said that. I'm the one who came up with this. I'm the one who got the figures. I'm the one who's written the essays on it. I'm the one that warned about this from day one. And I'm the one person that's banned from talking about it. And I can tell you this now. If this plays out as I've predicted, and I hope it doesn't, I hope Rupert Lowe and Restore stand down and just let Reform smash the two-party system and win the next general election. I hope that happens. And then we have to hope and pray that Farage and the people around him either do the right thing or have a catastrophic split and an ethno-nationalist group emerges from that and forms some kind of coalition government that steers things in the right way. We have to hope for that and pray for that. Because really, there's no other options. We've run out of time. It's pretty simple. So anyway, that's the end of the stream. And there we go. So we're going to do the super chats now. Somebody just left a comment about something in the chat. I'm going to ask him to elaborate. But I'm going to do the super chats. And if anyone else wants a super chat, they can. It'd be very helpful if they did. If you don't, no problem. Archie Debunker gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, I watched Professor Yang's year-old video. He talked about elite theory, baby boomers, mouse utopia, and Canada's immigration. He says that it isn't the Jews. It's the baby boomers who won't give up status. I think, look, what I'm about to say is going to be deeply unpopular, probably with everyone. I believe that Jews wield disproportionate power in the West. Do I believe that every single problem that we face today, is solely down to Jews? No. I think that in almost every case, Jews got the ball rolling. They got the ball rolling with pornography, with feminism. They control banking, campaign finance, the media. But the problem we face now is much bigger, because post-Second World War, we've seen many people flock to the cause of cultural Marxism. And some people seem to think that if you had a big magic red button and you pushed it and, you know, every Jew on the planet got in a big spaceship and flew off to Alpha Centauri to create their own perfect world, and we were all left alone, the world's problems would immediately solve themselves. I'm skeptical about that. And I'm skeptical about that because I think there are enough anti-white white people. There are enough anti-white people of other races. And there are enough people who are working now within structures, probably structures set up by groups that were disproportionately Jewish, which now have their own steam. They operate under their own steam. The Fabian Society, the Labour Party, the Conservatives. they're all now operating under their own steam. And the anti-white agenda has got so much power and is propped up by so many white people as well, that the issue no longer is just solely Jews, Jewish power. They got the ball rolling, but it's like they pushed the snowball down the hill. But now the snowball's rolling. It's picked up weight and momentum of its own, and it becomes a problem in itself. And I think the issue that we're facing here today is that roughly sort of around 50% of white people almost seem committed to our own demise for one reason or another, whether it's that they do actually agree with us in some ways but still vote against us, or whether many of them are actually committed to a multiracial Britain because they have family members, friends who are of migrant descent. And I've got to say, once these things gather their own pace, once these organisations, let's like the BBC. The BBC isn't completely Jewish. There are many white people in the BBC who are absolutely awful people who control power. And if, as I said, if every Jew tomorrow quit working in the BBC and walked out the door, it wouldn't become a pro-white organisation. It would still be filled with anti-white whites. And that's one of the problems. It's very much similar to what we've seen in academia. So the problems we've seen in academia are not all. They might be the result of cultural Marxism, and we know who started that. But the people implementing that cultural Marxism in academia now are, for the most part, unfortunately, white people. And we face this incredible problem that so many of our people are now brainwashed and working against us, that it makes it harder than ever before to push back against the problems we face. What's more, multiculturalism, whether people want to admit it or not, has taken root. And unfortunately, one of the big issues we face is people won't vote for a party that they think might do something like deport their grandchildren or their nieces and nephews. And I see what people, I see the point of it's not the Jews. Well, they did get the ball rolling. And I can see what this guy's trying to say. I can see what he's trying to say. He's saying it's the baby boomers. It's not the Jews. Well, who started feminism? Who controlled the porn industry? Who came up with the comic book characters? Who controls Hollywood and the media? And who are the people who got the ball rolling? Well, it was them. But now it's gone further than that. And the problem now is that many whites, including boomers, won't give up their status. And I have spoken about that. It's interesting that he said that. I'd be actually interested to have, he probably wouldn't have a conversation with me, but I would have a conversation with him, because I did do a stream about the fact most boomers won't give up on their house prices, that they would want migration to carry on because migration is one of the primary drivers of the housing boom. So he has got a point there. I think it's far too complex to just write it off now as one thing. It's far too complex. And it was actually somebody who sort of really got me onto this was actually interesting, the Patriarch. And it was the Patriarch talking about Christian Zionism and how now some of the biggest lobbying groups in America are actually, who are lobbying for Israel and for more wars, aren't actually Jewish groups. They're white Christian Zionists that absolutely believe that they are doing God's work with what they're doing. And this is what I mean about somebody gets the ball rolling, or that somebody kicks the snowball down the hill, but it gathers pace, and then it grows this light. It becomes, has a life of its own, effectively. Anyway, Archie Debunker gave another $5. Thank you much. Says, is the greed of the baby boomers a global problem that demands mass immigration to keep stocks and house prices up? What will happen when the boomers rapidly die off? Look, there is an absolutely huge, huge problem with the way people in Britain view house prices. And I've spoken about this. Britain has a strange housing market in that more than 50% of adults own their own home, which makes Britain stand out internationally as a place with extremely high home ownership. And because of that, most families and most individuals tie their net wealth to the, or net worth to the price of their home, to how much their home is valued at. And the issue is this: the housing market boom is now central to our economy. Endless houses need to be built. Endless number of people need to be employed to build those houses. A few years ago, there were so many houses being built, we had to employ special finders to go out to places like Eastern Europe to recruit Romanian and Polish builders to come here to build the houses. That's how many houses we're building. Because demand is outstripping supply. But when demand outstrips supply, not only does the housing market boom because more houses are being built and that creates jobs and wealth in itself, but house prices skyrocket. And boomers look at their house prices and say, look, Beryl, we bought this for $100,000 back in 19XX and now it's worth $400,000. Wow! And to them, they've made 300,000+. It was a great investment. It's something to leave to their children. They feel good about themselves. They feel like they've got this wealth. You know, an Englishman's home is his castle and all of that. And this creates an issue. It creates a problem, right? Whereby if you said tomorrow, we're getting rid of 25%. We're stopping all immigration and we're getting rid of 25% of the population because we're deporting them. Okay. What would happen? Well, you wouldn't be building new houses. There'd be a massive crash when it came to house building. Lots of people would be made unemployed. There'd be huge economic problems. And people would lose a massive chunk of the value of their homes. If your home was worth 400 grand and we lost 25% of the population, you might lose 100, 150 grand overnight. Your house price would just plummet. Now, I don't care. I don't give two hoots about that. If you said to me, look, Mark, your house is worth $250,000. And if you get rid of 25% of the population, get rid of, you know, the vast majority of the migrants, your house is only going to be worth 125 grand. It's going to be halved overnight. I'd be like, I don't care. Good. Who cares about 125 grand? If all I had to give up was 125 grand of my house price to create a future for my children and to ensure they live in a homogenous or overwhelmingly homogenous 95% white British country, I'd do that tomorrow in a heartbeat. I wouldn't, you know, if you said to me, that's the option, keep your house price at 250 grand or your house value drops to 125 grand overnight, but you're living in a homogenous 95% white British country. And there was two buttons there in front of me. I wouldn't even hesitate. Boom, I'm pushing it. The migrants are going. And there it is. My house price has gone through the floor, but who cares? But that's not how people think. That's not how the vast majority of people think. They tie their generational wealth to their house price. And because they do that, they're in a situation where they can't let go. They can't let go of that wealth. And if the government said to them tomorrow, look, you can go back to a 95% white British Britain with the overwhelming majority of the migrants being from Eastern Europe, so they're white and they're like us, but your house price will drop by up to a third, or we can carry on as we are, and your house price will keep skyrocketing. I do believe a lot of boomers and a lot of homeowners, most of the homeowners are that sort of people, they would keep voting for more migration to keep their house prices going up, because that's how people look at things through an economic lens. I'm different. I'm an outlier. And I'm guessing most people in the chats tonight would agree with me. But unfortunately, that's not how normal people think. Reactionary traditionalists gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, I know they're not our guys, but do you think AfD winning Saxony and Halk could be a huge positive precedent, assuming there isn't an extremely fragile CDU, SPD, Gruner, Linker coalition? Look, AfD aren't our guys in the same way that Reform aren't our guys. AfD and Reform, they're similar. And they're all similar. They're similar to Marine Le Pen. But look, AfD winning in Saxony would be beautiful. Just like if Marine Le Pen won in France, that would be beautiful. None of these people are our guys. You know, Front National is now, unfortunately, pro-Zionist and pro-gay. But is there a better option in France? You know, Reform is not the option I would want to vote for. But is there any better option to break the two-party system? No. AfD is not the party I would choose. I love Sacha Rossmuller. I love his party. I love what he's doing. I don't think there's any greater German alive today than Sacha Rossmuller. But unfortunately, he ain't going to win. He's not the one who's going to be winning in Saxony. So you have to, you know, this late stage of the game, you either, you know, go all in on the party that can win and kick the others out, or you sit on the sidelines and do something more ideological. I'm doing something more ideological, but I definitely hope the AfD win, despite me understanding their shortcomings. Fancy Pants and MP5s gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, Adam Green has a point to many stuck in the Christian, in Christianity, in that it's not compatible with common sense, blaming demons for their problems. Is any religion, could you say any religion's compatible with common sense? You could say this about pagans. You could say it about Christians. They all have their beliefs, and you could laugh and mock anyone's beliefs. If a pagan comes to me and says, Mark, I'm a pagan, and I'm pro-white first, and I want to stand with you, I'll stand with him. If a Christian comes to me and says, Mark, I'm a Christian, and I'm pro-white first, and I want to stand with you, I'll stand with him. The pagans and the Christians fighting a battle over who's more pro-white and who has the right to our ancestral homelands and whose religion is more more noble than the others. It's the most pointless debate. You know, what are they going to do? Roll around in the mud scrapping over religion whilst Islam takes over? Because that's the reality. If the pagans and the Christians want to fight each other, they're welcome to do so. But whilst they fight each other, there is going to be one religion that rapidly takes over Britain. And if you look at how many mosques are popping up all over the country, I think you know who's coming out on top. And it isn't the Christians and the pagans. And if they want to pull themselves together and put their differences to one side and fight against the invasive religions that are coming here from the Indian subcontinent and the Middle East, that's what they should do. But fighting each other at this late stage, to me, pointless. And you're wrong. Fancy Pants and MP5 says pagans don't actually think there is Odin up there. They just see divinity in nature. That is absolutely untrue, mate. I don't want to be disrespectful. You've been very kind with your super chat. I had a guy on there on PWR the other week called Matthew Flavelle, and I said to him, do you believe that Odin and Thor are literal gods, or are you just a pagan who believes in the divinity of nature and a necessity of closeness with the natural world, that white people thrive in the natural world? And he said, no. He said, I believe absolutely that Odin is his god. He believes that Thor is a god. He believes in pagan gods in the same way that Christians believe in, you know, Jesus, God, and, you know, the Virgin Mary. So, you know, Odinists and pagans do believe in gods as a literal thing. So you can say, oh, Odinists, you know, are different, but they're not. You know, I actually had an Odinist on, and when he said, no, I literally believe Odin is real, these are my gods, I worship them, I was like, well, that's cool, that's your belief system. And I don't see that really as any different when a Christian sits in front of me and talks about their God. Now, I don't think I have any right to legislate to anyone who, you know, who they worship. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, if we have a pro-white Christian and a pro-white pagan, they should stand together, because if they don't, they're both going to lose out. Archie Debunker gave $5. You know, and he said, don't you know that China made ghost cities modeled after France and England so that mass migrants from Europe feel at home? Yes, I do. I've seen these and I think they're amazing. So, and I once remarked that if you went to the Paris located in China, you would probably be a lot safer than if you went to the Paris located in France. You know, that's the sad truth of the matter, isn't it? If you go to the Paris in France, you're probably more likely to be stabbed than if you go to the Paris in China. And I've often thought, would it actually be somewhere where we could go? You know, if you said to the Chinese, look, there's 250,000 white Frenchmen who wish to escape France because of multiculturalism. Can we move into your version of Paris and make it a safe place for Chinese tourists to visit? Would they come? Maybe. Is it a solution? Not an ideal one, but when the choice is stabby migrants or a clean new Paris the other side of the world, well, it's, you know, maybe you've got to buy that plane ticket. I don't know, but I do find it interesting they did that, and I find it fascinating that they would build a perfect replica of European cities to marvel at when our European cities are falling into disrepair. What a way to end the stream. Anyway, I'd like to thank everyone who's super chatted tonight. I think it's been a good stream. I hope you've all enjoyed it. I'm going to get off now, but we've got a review of the Odyssey on Sunday night. I hope you tune in for that. Anyway, thanks so much for being with me. Thank you again to everyone who was so generous to Super Chat. I hope that anyone out doing any activism this weekend stays safe, stays within the law. And I hope to see you all on Sunday. And also I'll be back on Wednesday with Blair Cottrell. We'll be talking about the weight of the movement and the way that, unfortunately, it takes too much of a toll on people. We'll be talking about the suicide of Tim Lutz in Australia. So there you go. Thank you so much for being with me. I hope to see you on Sunday, and if not on Wednesday. I love you all. See you again soon. Thank you and good night. Oh, check out my Substack.